Okay, if you have not sent me something, people at home, you need to send me something because this is enrollment verification week. And I have to verify that you're in the class, which means I have to have gotten an email from you. There, now I've set it for them too. Okay, I'm going to spend a little more time on access, and then I'm actually going to start looking at a few things from the book. So, I'm bringing up this access database that I've brought up repeatedly from week two, just because we're all familiar with the names of the fields and everything else, so it's a good one to just keep going back to. Yeah, and I don't care whether you bring up, I brought up the 11 o'clock class, but it doesn't matter. Okay, but it's in week two, and it says from the 11 o'clock class and from the 12:30 class, and it's there in case you don't have a copy of it with you. Okay, so there's the table. Okay, again, it's ID number, STU name, major, courses, and GPA. So that's the name, that's what's in the table. So we're going to look at SQL a little bit more. So I'm going to go in here and say create, query design, and I'm going to close. And that gives me the SQL view. And I also want to bring up Notepad. Okay, so I'm going to say select asterisk from STU table where, and now I write down the conditions that I want. So let's say that I want to have everybody have a GPA greater than 3. Okay, so I want a GPA greater than 3, and I want courses less than 20. You're right. So, and that. So go ahead and do that one. And then when you get that one done, change the and to an or. And do a second one with the and the or. With just the or, rather. GPA greater than 3 and courses less than 20. So it's GPA greater than 3 and courses less than 20. Okay, so I'm going to write where GPA greater than 3 and courses less than 20. Okay, so I can just put my conditions there. Now, thinking back to the user interface, where would these two things have gone? On what line? Both on the criteria line. Okay, because they're in an and relationship. So, now I'm going to save this. And I'm going to take it up there and put it into the right place. Okay, and again, the only reason I don't write up there is it's hard for you to read. So I write it in Notepad so you can read it. So I have now got what I want, and I am going to view it. And I now see that apparently somebody greater than 3 and courses less than 20, there was one person that met the criteria. So there's one person that's showing up. Okay. Now, if I go back to SQL view and change this to an OR, okay, so now I've got the OR there. So I've said now GPA is greater than 3 or courses less than 20. And again, if I went back to the user interface, where would I put GPA greater than 3? On the criteria line. Where would I put courses less than 20? On the OR line. Okay, so I would have one thing on the criteria line and one thing on the OR line. So I've now got the OR there instead of the AND, and when I run it, I get a lot of people. Okay, because a lot of people had a GPA greater than 3. Notice this one here did not meet the greater than 3. They got there because they had less than 20 courses. Okay, but in the OR, there's a, the one on the top got there for both reasons. Because they had less than 20 and they also had a GPA greater than 3. So they got there for both reasons, but that doesn't matter. They only need to get there for one. Okay? Okay, so now let's say I only want to see people that are greater than 2,000. So let me... The eraser, apparently, it doesn't like the way I placed it. There. Are you happy now? No, it's still not happy. Now it seems to be happy. Okay. So now I'm going to say I want... Okay, quiet please. I want an ID number that is greater than, I think it's a 5-digit ID number, right?
Well, it's 20,000.
Right, but it's a 5-digit ID number. Okay? And either a major equal to BU or courses greater than 20. Okay? So, I want ID number greater than 2,000. That's absolutely necessary. That has to be true. And in addition, either the major of BU or courses greater than 20. So write that. Have most of you got that?
Now, when you're testing for the two, I think about it with an aim, just to do my test for two. Test better than I do it, major, this whole section. So, basically, what I'm saying is, it's like, my physical parentheses and stuff. It can, but because it's a planned statement, it's connecting these two. Right, so this is the constant.
Okay, so now let's take a look at this. Okay, so I'm going to say where ID number is greater than 20,000, it's a five-digit ID, and major equals, what do I write here? In quotes, right. Or courses greater than 20. Is that right?
Semicolon.
Right. Is that correct?
No.
No. What's wrong with it?
No parentheses.
No parentheses. Where do I need the parentheses?
For major and at the end of 20.
You got it. Okay. Because that now says where the ID is greater than 20 and... You can almost read that as an either. And either. Major equals. So again, I'm asking in the logic for ID number greater than 20,000. And if that's true, I continue. If it's not, I'm out of here. And if I continue, I'm asking, is the major equal to BU? If the answer is yes, I display. If the answer's no, then I've got one more chance. And I ask, is the courses greater than 20? If the answer's yes, I display. And if the answer's no, I have no more chances. So I close up that decision. I go up to the next level and close that one. And I go to the next level and go all the way through the yeses and close that one. Okay? So that's the logic that I'm looking at there. Okay. There's a second way that I could have written that. And I could have written it as ID number greater than 2,000 and major equals BU, or ID number equals 20,000 and courses greater than 20. In other words, I can repeat it twice.
Well, that's what I did.
Okay, and that's fine too.
Would you use two,
and I'll look
two
at
lines.
That.
Would you use two lines for that?
Doesn't matter.
One line.
Doesn't matter. If I were in the user interface, obviously I got two lines in both of them.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter.
It did all matter.
So I'm going to go in and take this and come over here to SQL view and paste it in and then run it. Data type mismatch and criteria expression. Okay.
The ID number is a short test.
Right. So, what did I get? Okay, quiet for a minute so that you can see this. Okay, I ran this and I got data type mismatch and criteria expression. Okay, so what it's looking for is it wants the same data type on each side. Well, major is text, short text, and BU is in quotes, so that makes it a text. So that's happy. Courses is number, and that is testing against a number, so it's happy. Over here, I've got ID number as, oh, cute, as short text, and the 20,000 is clearly a number. So I'm comparing short text to a number, and it's not happy with me. Okay, so what I can do is go in and say, okay, close Inclea? Yes, can we close the Inclea? Thank you. Okay, and come up here and put quotes around the 20,000. Now, if I didn't know, I'd have to go back and look at the description of my table to try to figure out. But I knew I was right on the other two, so I knew it had to be the ID number. Okay, and I remember that I gave that short text. So, and I apparently didn't get the quote there. There it is. Okay, so now I'm going to view it, and there were three people that met the criteria. Notice they all have greater than, all of them are greater than 20,000. Okay, two of them are BU, so two are BU. The non-BU had better have courses greater than 20, and it does. Okay? So the not BU had courses greater than 20. And so that's fine. Okay? So the alternative way of writing that would be to come in and say AND major equals BU. I got to put the around it.
I did single quotes on mine, it works.
That's what, fine.
Oh, okay.
And it's probably not a bad idea, especially since you're in the Oracle class.
Yeah, I don't want to be typing the shifts.
Okay, so that's an alternative way that you can do it.
Now, within, when you put the number within quotations, it's considered what, a string?
A string,
at that time?
Yeah.
So how does it know that you're actually testing for a number versus any characters?
It doesn't. It's just testing any characters. That's exactly what it's doing. It's a text. I'm putting in text.
Right. Now, would it be just more efficient to change the variable type of the ID number to an integer and not have to put the quotes in at all?
I don't think it probably cares, it as in the computer that's processing. Okay, it just wants the things that match. And what it does is it compares character by character. So it looks at the first number and ID number compares to that. Looks at the second character compares and goes on and compares like that. Yeah, you were going to say.
I was just going to say you need an AND after right before courses.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you're right. So now I'll take the picture again. So that is the way that you could do it. Now again, remember ANDs get resolved before ORs. So that means, love that. Okay, so the first thing it does is resolve this. So that's the first thing it resolves. Okay, ANDs before ORs, moving left to right. So the second thing it does is resolve this. And then the third thing it does is resolve the OR. Which basically says, okay, those two or those two. So that's the order that it does the stuff in. Okay. I claim that the parenthesis looks more professional. That as a professional, that's the way I would do it. Okay. So if I now take this and put it in there. Actually, I didn't want to cancel that. Okay, go back to the SQL view and put it in. I'm going to get the same results. Okay, so I got the same results when I went in there as on the other one. Okay. Now, if I go in and look at this in the user interface, I have got notice. The thing that has to be true is on both lines. And then it's this or this. Okay, now last night I sent back somewhere between a little under 10 probably people, and there were quite a few that had this mistake. So, okay, those of you who got it back, pay attention and send it back to me, okay? The thing that has to be true has to be on both lines. And that's why we do the send it back, because I'm not content until you've learned it. Okay? So, therefore...
Ask you, I find it so much easier.
Yeah, I actually agree. I like writing in SQL. Okay, so that is basically any questions. Do you all feel comfortable enough now? Because I'm going to be putting up an SQL homework tonight. So, questions?
It was again. It's weird how the differential between writing the code the long way versus using the parentheses actually creates a different output in the design view.
Yeah, let me see. Okay, so if I take this, okay, go into the SQL view, and put around that, so I need to put the parenthesis there, and I need to get rid of this. And I need to put the parenthesis there. Have I got it right?
Yep.
Okay.
I think so.
So now I'll go and look. Was it, so I'm going to view it. It's working. Now I'll go into that view.
Yeah. It's still correct. It just
right.
groups it differently.
Yeah, right. You're right. So it put it as in, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But don't forget, it resolved the or first, but this doesn't kind of hold up to that because then it should have had those first two things and then worried about the major. So, whatever, however it does, magic happens, but it came up with the right answer. That's interesting, actually, that it did that. Oh, well, the other thing is, if you recall, I pointed out to you when we went back and looked at it before, if you remember, it had all of the things I wanted to see, and then it put these three at the end that don't have the show. They don't have anything checked to show here, which is really kind of bizarre. Because if you look, it's saying do this, but the show are all unchecked.
That might be a bug though with Microsoft.
I mean, I'm sure they're going to show it.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
But they're, the one that I showed you earlier when I was showing you the difference, put all of the fields at the beginning and then put the ones that had the criteria at the end, but they were a no-show. This one just doesn't even bother to list, which is really kind of strange.
Maybe the SQL just overwrites whatever access is going and just runs the code.
Oh, it does. No, and the SQL definitely was the winner there.
Right.
But...
I was going to say, if you want, just hit the check marks on the shows and see what happens. We'll just show three columns. We'll show probably three more.
That would be interesting, yes. Okay. So now we'll check those and go back.
No. Why even have it do that?
Well, I mean, the user interface, as I said, is put there because Access is trying to be nice to... humanity that doesn't understand SQL.
Not everybody using Access is going to use SQL.
That's right, exactly.
So it's user-friendly on
exactly.
the other end.
So they put it up for there. But in fact, they turn everything into SQL.
Right.
So when I write it in SQL, apparently they just kind of sort of turn it into the user interface.
It changes the order, though, when you check it.
Yeah.
Because now your major is the first.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's going to, I think it tests for criteria first, and then the first and statement, and then the or.
That's right. The
first, first is doing one side,
it does
one side,
and and then the or is how they resolve it. But I've always, there are a lot of parameters going on behind the scenes and how they print it. And basically, my attitude is, however they want to do it, that's fine. Now, notice what happened when I went back. Okay? Now look at what it did to me. It decided that I'd been playing around back and forth enough, and so it would fix everything for me. And I've got those 5,000 parentheses in there.
You needed the help.
Huh?
You needed the help.
That's right. So if I now go back to this one, I keep forgetting I don't want to actually close that down. And view it. It comes up that way. Alrighty, that's how that works. Okay, so now what we're going to do is actually, I'm going to talk about a few things that the book talks about. My attitude is, I think the book provides some really good information, but I think you can read as well as I can. So basically, most of the time, you're going to be reading the book, and I'm going to be doing the practical examples up here. But I want to go over a few things in the book, so I'm going to look at a few things. And you don't have to have your book. I'm just going to talk about a few things. One of the things that they talk about, you don't need a book. I'm going to put it up on the board. One of the things that they talk about in the book is the what happens when you write a program and when you compile it. Okay, they go through the whole business at the beginning where they talk about the fact that you have input, processing, and output. And that's true. When you write a program, the program is doing the processing. Okay? Now, I can write a program with no input and no output, but then I am not going to take anything in from the user, and I'm not going to show anybody anything. And so most programs have some kind of input coming in and something going out. Even if they don't have input coming in, they definitely have some response usually, because I'm writing it for a purpose, which means I want output. Okay? Now, there are mathematical things where they will actually hard code numbers into the program. That means they will put the numbers inside the program as opposed to asking somebody to enter them. And they may run for a long time and produce one answer if it's a complicated mathematical formula that they're trying to solve. So in that case, you only get output because you've hard-coded the input. You've hard-coded the data. What I want to talk about is writing a program, because we're going to be doing logic next, and then we're going to start to write programs, and we're going to write with two languages. We're going to start with JavaScript, which is embedded with HTML, and we're going to look at that first, and then we're going to look at Visual Basic. So essentially, what you do when you're writing a program is you first, you analyze the problem. Okay, you want to analyze the problem and figure out what people want you to do, because you're usually solving some kind of a problem. So you're analyzing it and figuring out what they want to do. Once you've figured out what they want you to do, then you have to think about the logic. Okay? And essentially, programmers deal with logic and with code. At one point, they decided they were going to break those two parts up, and they were going to have one person figure out the logic and another person write the code. Guess who got paid the most? the person that had to figure out the logic.
That's the tough part.
That's the tough part. Figuring out the logic is the tough part. Coding is going to seem tough to you when you do it if you haven't programmed before. But once you understand the code for a particular language, then it's not hard. It's the logic that's hard. If you don't understand how to do the code, then obviously the code is hard. But after you, when I first learned to program, I had graduated from college with a degree in economics. And I decided I wanted to program. I'd done something with computers for a summer job, and this looked like fun, so I decided to apply for programming jobs. So I got hired as a programmer. Back then, they didn't teach it in school that much. And I got hired as a programmer, and I got sent to about a week and a half or 2 weeks' worth of classes. You know, and so I graduated from college thinking I was pretty smart. And then I went to this week and a half, 2 weeks of classes. Never felt so stupid in my life. I didn't have a clue. I came back and they said, okay, now start writing programs. And I came back and said, do you want me to do what? So there were three of us that were sent to this class, and we all pulled our chairs up to our boss's desk and sat there, and he basically got nothing done except teaching us how to program. So, but once I understood coding, then the logic became the problem. Okay, so you figure out the logic, and then you write the code. Now, nowadays, very few people write in machine language when they write the code. They write in a high-level language, okay? Because, and I have actually written in machine language, and it takes a lot of time, okay? And I couldn't do it now. I don't remember how, but I have done it. And it takes a lot of time. If you write in a certain high-level language, then you write in something that is closer to English, and it translates for you. We get it translated. So when I have and I write a program, when I want to do some math or when I want to do some kind of thing, one expression for me, as in do a calculation, will be generated into a lot of instructions in machine language. Okay, so I can write in high-level languages one line that says do a calculation. The machine language for that would be many lines, okay, a lot of code. So what I do is I write the code. And so now I've got the code, and I usually am going to be writing it, sitting at a terminal and writing the code in there. Okay, so I'm writing the code. And then I send it in. And what I am sending it to is a compiler. And the compiler is sitting here. Here is the computer. And the compiler is sitting in here. Okay? Now, it could be either a compiler or an interpreter. Real sophisticated high-level languages are going to use a compiler. And a compiler goes in and does the translation of the whole thing and produces a machine program that can be run. An interpreter analyzes one line at a time. So when you see JavaScript, it's going to be an interpreter, where it's going to analyze one line at a time as it goes through it and let you know about the errors, and then you fix the error and go back and it analyzes the next line. Whereas a compiler will tell you all the errors that it could find. Now, sometimes one of the errors will mask some others. So when you fix one and compile it again, you'll find others. So it will mask some of them, but it will at least have run through the whole program. So you bring the, I'm going to talk about a compiler, and you bring the program in, and it turns it into machine language. So what you've been putting in is source code. It is the way you wrote it in a high-level language, and that's called source code. And what's coming out is object code. Okay, so the object code is what is coming out. It is producing the machine language program.
So the object code is what, like, the computer understands?
Yes. The object code is what the computer understands. And if you go back and look in your book, when you're at home at some point, you should hopefully have read this chapter. What I'm talking about is on page 3, so you can look at it when you get home. So it produces the object code, okay? It also gives you errors. So it tells you all of the errors. Now, if it comes back and says that you have a fatal error or an error, then it's not going to run. That object code is worthless. It may have generated some for you anyway, but it's worthless. Okay? So if you get errors, then what you have to do is go back over here, fix the errors, recompile, and hope that it worked this time. And if it does, gets more errors, go back, recompile, and you can frequently go through that cycle a couple of times before you get a clean compile. Okay? So what I want is a clean compile that gives me executable object code that I can execute. So when it finally gets no more errors, I'm going to put it back into the computer. And this time, it's the object code that is in here because it's the object code that is going to run. Okay? Over here, the compiler was sitting inside memory. And the compiler is a program. And the compiler was treating your source code as data. So your source code was the input to the compiler. It was creating two outputs. The object code and errors, if there were errors. Okay? So now the object code is going in. Well, probably you have some input. And so let's say you have some data out here on a disk that you want. That could be my input. Or let's say that you are putting it up on a screen and somebody's keying in data. Okay, so I could be either using data that's being keyed in from a screen, or I can be using data that has been stored on a disk, and I am now handling that data. Okay, so...
You can also pull from databases at that point, too.
Right, well, I'm thinking of data up there is probably a database, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm pulling, and, you know, a lot of programs in reality are using the data that's there. Sometimes you're using both. So I could also have, if I wanted to, input coming in that was, oh, that was good. Oh, well. Input coming in, that particular part of the screen isn't working too happily. I could also have input coming in from the user. So the user could be, say, putting in a query, for example, okay? And I can be going and query. They can put in the query that they want. Then the program could be going out to the data and querying the data and giving me the result, okay? So they could be putting in input. I can be having input come in here from the screen as well, okay? Then my output is whatever I'm asking for. My output might be output to a screen. It might be output to, that says or, believe it or not. Not too well. It might be output that is going out to paper. It might be output going to a disk. But I've got output coming out of here going somewhere. Whether it's screen or paper or disk, it's going someplace. I also, so let's say I could also get output that was going to paper, or I can get output that is going to a disk. Okay, so I can get output going in a variety of places, depending on what I said I wanted to do in the program. Okay, so now I have got a certain kind of error that has come out. Okay? The errors, I can also, over here I got a list of errors. Here, I'm going to have to figure out what the errors are. okay? These tend to be syntax errors. This one will have logic errors if it has errors. So I look at the results, and let's say I was calculating pay, and the first person had a pay of $20 an hour, and they worked 40 hours, okay? And the answer came up as 60. Okay, so what does that mean I did?
It's adding up.
I added instead of multiplying. And so the computer doesn't know that's an error, because the computer has no idea. It's doing what I told it to do. But if I told it to add, and I should have been telling it to multiply, then I'm going to look here and see that I'm going to be paying this person $60, and they're not going to be too happy. Okay? So I then need to go back. So if I find a logic error, I've got to come all the way back over here, change the code, go in and find that plus sign and change it to a multiply sign, recompile the program, and then re-execute it. Okay, because I had to go back and make the change in the high-level language that I write in, and then it had to turn it into the machine language that the computer can follow. Okay, and create the output that the computer can follow. So, when I first started programming, I was in Providence, and the computer we were using, it was a bank, and the computer we were using was under an apple orchard out in the middle of the state someplace. So we literally wrote our programs, that was in the old days, and they carried it, took it out, and ran it on the computer in the apple orchard and brought it back. So we didn't see the errors till the next day. Okay? So you really tried to be careful when you weren't going to see the errors till the next day. And in fact, here at BCC, at one point when I first started teaching here, they didn't have computers. And so we had to send our stuff over to UMass Dartmouth. UMass Dartmouth to run. And again, we wouldn't get them back for a day. They'd go take them over there, run them, and send them back. So you work in a lovely world where you get the output within minutes and tells you what you did wrong. Okay? But there was a time when that wasn't happening.
I probably wouldn't want to be a programmer if it was still that way.
Well, you just moved on to the next program. And the time, I mean, there were less time pressures. I mean, I can remember when I was under time pressure, you'd go out to the Apple Orchard.
Right.
And you'd go into the underground thing that held these computers, and you would stay there for a day or two and get it working. But, you know, on the whole, there wasn't the big time constraints, and so you just went on to something else you were working on. Okay. All right, questions on this? Other than I'm glad I lived today and not then.
So is it true to say that every high-level language is built off of machine code?
Built off of, I'm
meaning
not...
Meaning that it's the high-level language transfers to machine code.
It has to.
No matter which...
It has to. I mean, the computer's a dumb machine.
Right.
And it does zeros and ones real well. But, I mean, it has to have everything broken down to it so that it can work off its circuits and do the stuff. So, yes, it has to be translated. It absolutely has to be translated in order to be able to do it. So that is what they cover in chapters 1 and 2. Then they give this little chat that I started to do up there, where I says they give the chat, and I'll put the chat up on the board. Okay, quiet, please. If you want to talk, why don't you go out in the hall, okay? Okay, so I put, if you look in the book when you get home, it says understand the problem, which is what I did. And then it says, here, L-E-M, that's what it has in L. And then it says plan the logic. And then it says code, the program. Okay, so that's as far as I went, and then I went off and did the kind of the drawing up there. But they say use software, a compiler or interpreter to translate the program into machine language. So we're going to put down here that you need to translate. And depending on the language you're using a compiler or an interpreter. Okay, and again, an interpreter goes through the things in the program and translates as it goes. So it translates line one, translates line two, it does it as it goes, whereas a compiler looks at the whole thing. Okay, so then after we translate, we test the program, which is what I did up there, and I talked about the testing the program and the logic. Okay, and then the next two steps, they say, to put the program into production. And then the next step is maintenance. I don't know if I spelled that right, but that's all right. Okay, so I started to write maintain, and then I decided to write maintenance. So anyway, what that means is once the program has been tested, and you really need to test it with sample data, which is what you're going to do, and then you need to test it again with real live data if you can, so that you test it with volume data. But you usually test it with some sample data, and what you try to do with the sample data is put in all the things you think could go wrong. Now, the problem is that you may not think of everything that can go wrong. So lots of times companies will have other people prepare the test data for you. Okay, and if they don't think of it all, maybe the combination of yours and theirs will test everything. Okay. So you try to test it as well as you can, and then if impossible, you try to use live data to test it and see if you get the results on live data. Eventually, you decide it's working and you put it into production, which means it's actually generating the paychecks, okay, or doing whatever it is that you wanted to do, so you put it into production. Now, maintenance is simply that no program is going to not need to be changed. Okay? First of all, let's say you're doing tax programs. The IRS changes the rules constantly. So, therefore, you have to go back and change the way your program operates if you are doing that. Okay? The other thing is maintenance, just things can change and you have to go back in and make changes to accommodate it. It also can be that the people who gave you the problem look at it and said, you know, it would be a lot better when you give me, let's say, this report, whether it's on screen or paper, if these two columns were next to each other, because I compare that. I didn't think about that when I first gave you the problem, but it would be a lot more effective if you could change it so these two columns were next to each other. So you go in and change it for them. Usually what we've done is that you are very accommodating at the beginning, and then after the beginning, after everything is set, you basically say, okay, we will take your requests and we'll look at this program every 3 months or every whatever time period you want to pick, and then we'll do the maintenance on the program altogether. We're not going to keep going in and fixing this little thing and that little thing, unless it's critical. If it's critical, then obviously we'll go in and fix it tomorrow or today. But if it's not critical, if it's just, it would be nice if, will handle the it would be nice ifs in scheduled periods. So maybe every 3 months, every 4 months, something like that.
And you would just run updates, and in the original coding of the program, you would have it initially check for updates before it continues through the rest of the process.
Well, updates in, as in, what do you mean by updates?
Well, if they wanted to make changes, you know,
right.
say you sell a product, all these people have it, they put it on all their computers, now you make an update or you make changes, you need to get it out to
all. You have to put it back into production too, yes.
Right.
So once you've done the maintenance, you're going to basically, maintenance involves going and understanding what the problem is, changing the code, going through all this, and putting the new version back into production.
Right. But in order to get it to all of those people who are...
That's right. If you, you're right. Then you have to do all of that. You have to go out and distribute it, and you have to distribute documentation that tells them what to do with it and how to fix it and all of that kind of stuff. Or if you're online, you can magically update the stuff and they hardly know it's happening. I mean, a lot of places are doing that now where,
right.
you know...
It just happens in the background.
It just happens in the background and you have never even know it got fixed unless it's something that is going to be changing how you run the program. You know, if it's not changing how you're going to run with it, just magic happens. Okay. Okay, and then they go on about that quite a lot. And then over on page 11-ish, they talk about pseudocode and flowcharts. And we're going to look at that. We've looked at flowcharts. And actually, they are logic flowcharts. And we've looked at those. And we're going to look at those some more in the next couple of weeks. And then there is pseudocode. So pseudocode is simply writing out the logic in English, writing out the words. So it basically says, take in... K per hour and hours. Multiply. And then display answer. And that's obviously a very broken down. But that's the kind of thing that pseudocode does. It says take in the pay per hour and the hours, multiply them together, and display the answer. So it's written in English, which basically means that you can write out the program without worrying about the syntax and the language. You can just sketch out what you want to do. And then you can then follow that sketch when you're going to do it. And it depends on what kind of a learner you are, whether you like the logic flowchart better or the pseudocode. I like the logic flowchart. I like to be able to visualize and to see the yes-no statements and all of that. And I just find that I operate better with a flowchart. Other people find that they don't like the graphic, that they like looking at the sequential going down there. So these are two tools, and there are other tools, and multiply doesn't have an L, but if I put it in, it's going to go in the wrong place. So I think we'll be able to do that now. So these are two of the tools that people use a lot when they are developing the logic for their programs. Now, when I ask you to develop the logic, a lot of you are going to, and pass it in, a lot of you are going to pseudocode simply because you don't want to have to draw the flowchart in such a way that it's readable and passable inable. Okay. Another thing that they talk about in here, and I'm kind of skipping here and there because we're going to start looking at programs, and I'd rather just kind of do that as we're going along. They talk about on page 15, they talk about variables, variable names, and literals. I actually don't think they talk about literals there, but I'm going to. So, in memory, I can, if I am setting up something, I can define a variable. So, continuing on with the payroll that I had, I can set up a variable in memory called, for example, pay per hour. And I can set up another one called hours. And I can set up a place to hold the answer called answer. So I can set up these in my programming language, and I am basically defining a variable. And so the user can input something, and when the user sends me input, I will say, okay, 20, 40, and then I will do a calculation and come up with 800. So I will do a calculation to do that, and the variables get stored in memory. When the next person gets processed, I can replace that 20 with their pay per hour. So if they make $30 an hour, I can just play that and change it to the 30. Okay, so the variables are variable. In other words, they can change. That's what a variable is. It can change. Then I can also have literals. And a literal is something that I define. And so I can say, all right, I'm going to have a literal of 1,000. And I'm going to say, I'm going to compare whatever answer you come up here with 1,000. And if the answer is greater than 1,000, I'm going to say, okay. And if the answer is not greater than 1,000, I'm going to say, I want to raise. Okay? So a literal is a number that I can just set up to use. And in this case, I'm comparing and saying I want to compare to 1,000. And if it's greater than 1,000, then I'm okay. If it's not greater than 1,000, I want to raise. And I can give that response out. But I'm comparing to a specific number, and I want to compare every answer that I calculate to that specific number and ask that question. So that's what's called a literal.
So that would be a fixed number, and in a program you would define it as, in, you know, when you declare variables, you would say A equals 1,000.
That's right.
You're setting the amount, but you still have to define it.
You still have, in some cases, although in the program I don't have to. I can actually write if answer greater than 1,000 right in the code. So I don't have to declare it. I can just use it right in my code. Now, probably I will declare it because I may want to change it next year and say, if I don't have more than 1,100, I want to raise.
Or you may use it in more than one place, and it may just be easier just to declare it
right
outright.
Right. But it's not a requirement. Assignment signs. Okay, when I'm writing a program, and I say, this is an assignment sign. And I say, answer equals pay per hour times hours. Okay? And in most languages, something similar to that would be an acceptable way of writing. Okay, so what I've got here is, we've already said these are variables. Okay, these are all, the names of the things are all variables. Multiply is done with an asterisk, because the closest thing on the keyboard to looking like a time symbol would be the X, and they don't want to mix in the characters of the alphabet with signs. So plus, minus, divide is a slash, and times is an asterisk. Now, you probably think you know what this is. It's not an equal sign. It's an assignment sign. Okay? looks like an equal sign, but it's not. It's an assignment sign. An assignment sign basically says, do the calculation on the right. Okay? Do the calculation on the right. And assign it to the answer on the left. And in programming, the answer, there's only one language that I have run into where the answer was on the right and the calculation was on the left. Everything else I've ever done, the calculation is over on the right and the answer is on the left. Okay? But either way, even if it's the flip of that, just forget the right and left part that I put up there and it still works. It's an assignment sign. Now, it's called an assignment sign because this is okay if I write count as a variable. And I write count equals count plus one. That's legitimate. Okay? That's not an equal sign because count doesn't equal count plus one. What that says is, add one to count. And then assign it back to count. So I start out and I have a variable called count. And maybe I give it an initial value of zero. Okay? So now I come in and I hit this command. And it says count equals count plus one. So I say, oh, add one to count, it's now a one. Put it back into count, assign it to count. So add one to count and put it back in count. When I hit this again, count is now a one plus one is two. It now is a two. When I hit it again, 2 plus 1 is 3, I assign it to count, this is now a 3. So it keeps, every time I hit that command, count will increase by 1. Okay, so clearly it's not an equal sign, because the two sides are not equal. It's an assignment sign. Do what's on the right, and assign it to the answer on the left. So it is an assignment sign. Questions? Okay. They get into a bunch of the stuff that we've looked at, which is the order of operations. Actually, I don't. Yeah, they do. Which is, we've talked about the order of operations, that ends get resolved before ors. That's part of the operation. Then there are other rules that you know from math here and there. Okay. First of all, parentheses get resolved first. Okay. And if you're dealing with math, then multiplication are actually powers. Yeah. Exponents. And then multiplication or division, and then addition or subtraction, and it works from left to right. And operations, if you're looking at logic, ands get resolved before ors. So if you're looking at a logical statement, ands get resolved before ors, but in the whole world, parentheses get resolved first. And then if you're dealing with math, you've got one set of rules, and if you're dealing with logic, you've got another set of rules. Okay? Now, the other thing that we've seen in access, and one of the reasons why we start with access, is that a lot of this kind of applies when you're doing queries and when you're setting it up. So they talk about, in page 19, numeric variables and string variables. okay? And they talk about the difference between a number and a string. And a string is considered text, okay? So you have two kinds of data. And there's two big pictures of the kinds of data you have. You have numbers, and you have string or text. Now, they may break these down like Access does, and Access has short text and long text, and numbers that have decimals and numbers that don't have decimals, and they break it down into, more detail. But the big picture is there's numbers or there's text fields, okay? Now, when you store data, if I have the number 1, 2, 3, and I store it in a 5-character field, it's going to store like that and probably throw in some leading zeros. If I have a string field, it's going to store it as 1, 2, 3, and have spaces here. And the diamond is the symbol for space. So it's going to have spaces there. So that's why it has problems comparing. Because if I compare those two, they're not the same. Okay? They're not the same. Now, if they were stored in a 3-character field, then it would probably stumble through and maybe figure it out. But if they're not the same when I store it that way. So numbers are stored up against the right wall, and characters are stored up against the left wall. And if you go into Access, you had to declare whether things were numbers or text. And this is the way they store. Okay? So a string or text is stored in that way, and it has trailing spaces if the field is too big. Numerics have leading zeros if the field is too big. Okay. Okay, the next part gets into programming, and we're going to look at that as we're going along and doing the program, so I don't want to go there right now. So, you've got 6 minutes to spare. Anybody got any questions?
With the interpreter versus compiler, when you go to run the interpreter, it stops you at the very first error, and versus the compiler just goes through everything.
And gives you all the errors.
And you can't continue with an interpreter until you fix that.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right. That's right. They both have pros and cons. I mean, I actually like getting the big picture and the whole thing back better. But probably that's also the way I learn, so.
Right.
I find an interpreter annoying at times, as it nitpicks me through the way instead of giving it all that I can work on.
Now, would you generally write, say you're working on a program, would you write a lot of code and then diagnose it, or would you try and accomplish a small task and then check to make sure?
With an interpreter, I try to do the small task because I like getting it clean and then adding another part, and I know where the error is going to be. With a compiler, I usually tend to write more the whole, a lot of the thing. And then, if I have subroutines that are specific, I may just not ignore those subroutines and write the big overall program and then go back in and add in the subroutines. So, but with an interpreter, I definitely tend to operate the way they do. Okay, I've got 5 lines, it's happy. Now I'm going to add 5 more and see what it thinks. And go through it that way.
Anyone need any help 2 to 3 o'clock today?
Yeah.
Wednesday, A118 from 2 to 4, I'll be in there.
And I will be here today at 1:45, or Pat and I will, one hour may come and go.
Yeah.
But I can stay till 4 if people are there by 3. It kind of closes down, so if you let me know, I can stay later. But I'm not going to stay later if nobody shows. So, in other words, if nobody's around at 3, I'm leaving. I have an hour's drive.
Well, I have no idea you lived up the South Shore.
I actually took the job when I lived in Seekonk.
Which makes sense. Like, you're living away.
But I like the job, so. Okay, we're done.